Welcome to the Clinical Research Coach Podcast. I'm your host, Leanne Wolke. In this podcast, we bridge conversations between industry, thought leaders, and patients. Utilizing a unique perspective, integrating years of coaching with Tony Robbins, coupled with scientific and industry experience, we have vulnerable and real conversations with the goal of impacting the industry in meaningful ways. So today on the podcast, I have Zane Corbet. Zane is the Chief Operating Officer and Strategic Growth Officer at Baha Clinical Trials. He's also the head of Zane Consulting. Zane, welcome. Let me have you just start off by introducing yourself. Tell us a bit about your background.
Well, hello, Leanne. Thanks so much for having me on your podcast. I'm a fan, and it's great to have a chance to talk to you about what I do. My name is Zane Corbet, and you know, I'm originally a Texan and made it my way to the West Coast to San Diego. And eventually I made it over the border to Rosarito Beach, which is about 35 miles from the San Diego-Tijuana border. I've been here about 2 years. Professional and personal interests brought me down this way. And now currently I own a research site in the Angels Hospital in Tijuana. In that role, I'm Chief Operating Officer and Strategic Growth Officer. And that would be the reason I came, was to develop the new markets, in particular the Baja California, Mexico area. So I'm one of the only research sites. I think there's two more that actually border the United States. And we're looking at unique recruitment opportunities for diversity and just another way of kind of doing the research. We're looking at it. We're very hands-on. It's very compassionate, a slightly different pace than the States, which I'm actually enjoying. And, you know, that's what's brought me down here. And I've been in the industry 33 years. So I'd love to tell you a little bit about that.
Absolutely. You know, and I grew up in Southern California. I went to school and grad school in San Diego. So I know the area where you're at very, very well. How does research in Baja differ than the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I looked coming over here, I just did a Google search. I go, there's got to be someone doing clinical trials in the area. And I found a group in the hospital that was relatively small. You know, they were actually working as a CEO and quality assurance and so forth. And they'd done a few trials, but wanted to grow. And so once I made the relationship, I was extremely happy with the quality of the individuals I met. It was a very warm, engaging culture. They saw the value of my presence coming in to increase the business. And, you know, we just started going out having casual lunches and dinners to get to know each other. And eventually, you know, it took about a year to be awarded the first trial. And that was from one of the prestigious and long-term relationships I have with the CRO. And they were absolutely instrumental for sending somebody down to take a look. You know, basically, they told the sponsor, we haven't worked with Baja Clinical Trials, but we work with Zane Corbet, and we feel comfortable authorizing the visit. And then that's what started. You know, we started, we won that trial. It's for MS, an indication that I really haven't worked on. My primary focus has been psychiatry, neurology for almost 33 years. It is something we'll be working on for next year, but right now I'm working with what we have in the hospital, and we're taking on MS and Alzheimer's for this year. We have a great patient population for that, and we would very much like to continue that growth, but I'm being very conservative for the first year. I want the hospital to be absolutely compliant and have us up to date before I invite everyone I've ever known down here. I think they would appreciate that. There are some different nuances, but that's what led me down over the border.
Tell me about those nuances.
The nuances. Well, you know, I tell people if they're coming down here to look for a carbon copy of the way we do things in the States, which is let's pump the brakes, somewhat of a frenzy, same day request, you know, not necessarily efficient as we could be. And, you know, so when I came over here from a personal standpoint, I wanted a more relaxed pace, you know, and I know that, you know, you have family living right where I'm living. So, you know, how it is in Rosarito Beach. I enjoy that very much. Did I think I could duplicate that at the hospital? I hope to bring a little of it that way. And, you know, it was the education they offered me, not the other way around, about the cultural differences. One was they wanted everything to slow down for a moment. Some of that also is that I'm not fluent in Spanish. And, you know, they wanted to understand what I was actually talking about. And so the physicians speak English, and I'm taking it much slower in my pacing. But what I found was they are very hands-on. I think originally in the States when I started, you know, the sites and the PIs were more hands-on than today. There's a lot of reasons for it. But at this point, with an emerging market and business that we have down here, I'm liking the social aspect. The two trials that have been awarded on the spot after the site evaluation, and it feels really great. They come in and they're so happy with my clinical staff that they feel comfortable moving forward. And I'm going to absolutely give credit to my staff for that. I know a lot of people that I can invite down and come, but primarily they're all recommendations going through Mexico City now. And so even though I have such a wide Rolodex, when we use Rolodexes at the time, a sponsor contacts, they give a recommendation, but they channel it through Mexico City. And so when the monitor in particular comes for a visit, what we do is I do an introduction in English and we go around the table and say what we need to say, and then we switch to Spanish. I'm the one individual that is not speaking Spanish. And so I know the slides, I know the information, and I'm happy they're there. What's coming through there is that they really like what they see. The Angels Hospital is quite beautiful. It's a private hospital, and we are a private research site within the hospital.
So many things here. You talk about you being the only one that doesn't speak Spanish in the room. So you're the outlier.
I am.
How does it feel to be in a meeting? I was in one recently where everyone was speaking a different language other than me. How was that for you?
Well, it's interesting to be preaching diversity in the United States and come over and be the one. That's the one thing. That's probably the biggest difference is having the shoe on the other foot, mm-hmm. and looking at the way that you're treated and so forth and so on, which the treatment of me has been absolutely lovely. There's no complaints whatsoever about that, but it is different. It is very different. You know, the perception, again, the doctors at the hospital speak English, but as you go through the ranks of other positions, such as phlebotomy, so forth and so on, it got to fall off pretty quickly there. And so my challenge, and I'm up for the challenge, is really perfecting my Spanish enough to have credibility within the hospital. I am the only gringo, so I do know what it's like to be the one now. And it's an interesting paradigm, you know, because I'm sitting there going, oh, I kind of understand now what it's like to be the diversity, mm-hmm. and what that's like for them to have the respect. I do think as I learn more Spanish, obviously my credibility will rise within the internal staff at this point. They recognize me by sight when I come through. I think it's the bright silver hair and maybe the blue eyes, and they go, oh, that's that dude from research. Uh-huh. And, you know, and again, I really enjoy it, but yeah, it is different. You know, I grew up in a, pretty redneck state, you know, in Texas. And I did, where the diversity was very much, there was a line drawn in the sand between the population. As I got out to San Diego way back in 96, that started blurring. And now it's completely a blur. And I'm really happy about that. I think, you know, we should be all inclusive in all ways. And so this is long overdue. And I'm really happy to see it happening in front of my eyes. And particularly the last 2 years, FDA has really mandated diversity. It's, again, I'll say long overdue. We probably could have put something in place for this previously. We can only go forward at this time. You know, we can't go back and talk about what could have and should have happened. But we're arriving in a new, complex and dynamic field. After 33 years, I see it dramatically changing. Post-pandemic, dramatically changing.
So tell me about, you know, I started in 95 in the day of three-part NCR forms and dinosaurs. I think there is so much change, which is exciting now. What do you think are the biggest movers of change in the industry at this point?
That is a very good question. I have a couple of different takes on there. I'm going to speak to CNS in particular, because that's been my focus. Mm-hmm. CNS is a very small group. And literally, when they say don't burn your bridge with somebody, they really mean it in CNS, because that individual will run the next project you're on. I've seen it numerous times. And fortunately, I've mostly been on the good side in favor of the sponsors. I've had my moments. But you know what I'm seeing that I think directly impacts those studies is the people that have owned and built those research sites for decades have either sold or they're going to sell. And so that is a big shift. CNS sites were built on names and reputation of the PI. You know, we all knew who Dr. Brown was from Austin, Texas, or we knew who this person was from Florida. And that was the draw. The branding was that PI or that site's name. Now, as large groups that I really like are buying sites like CynicCell, Alcanza, Meridian, you know, we see these big site networks really buying the best players out there. And generally, my understanding is that there usually is a time period they must remain within the site, anywhere from 2 to 4 years. And, you know, they're kind of on a strict non-compete a little bit afterwards. They don't want you to set up shop in the same town, which is respectable. But I see a dynamic sea change. I'm 58, and they've always been older than me. That's what I've always felt about the PIs. I'm like, they were always older. But now I'm up at that age. And, you know, my question would be, how long are you planning to stay? You're going to work till you die, you know, because these people have put in 35, 40 years in clinical trials, and they really did create the industry that we're in right now. We laid the foundation. I did. Other people did. We came up with the standard operating procedures, code of ethics at how we would run trials, but that's changing. And I think as you get the large site networks, what you're looking at more is numbers. And so people at a CRO might call and say, okay, I knew Leanne, but who took Leanne's place? And all that history goes out from the site. All that recruitment strategies, everything you ever knew that you put in place suddenly becomes invisible. That has a chain reaction. Goes back to pharma and CROs trying to hit their numbers based off a target of an individual that's no longer there. And I benefited greatly from that formula. The PIs I've represented for decades were constantly chosen. I did my best to make sure they stayed on the short list. And now we're looking at such a change of the guard, a sea change. It really is. Trying to find out who's on first, literally. Mm-hmm. Now, I've got some shelf life in me still. I'm fortunate that people are calling me for that reason. They said, who is running that bipolar project at that pharma company? I don't have a contact anymore. Fortunately, people will reach out and call me saying, Zane, I don't know the sites to call. And so we're able to do that and massage that for a while. But I think in the next 2 years, we're potentially looking at a drop in quality. I think that we're going not to have the expertise that we've had for decades. And the tricks of the trade, the magician tricks, everything we did to make a sponsor happy, generationally, they look at things very different. And we could sound like old people on this podcast going, when I did it, but it's true. When we were building the industry, I was so pleased at my job that I just did whatever they asked. Mm-hmm. I was so happy to be involved. I was at PPD for 7 years based in Austin. They organically grew the company, and there was so much opportunity for everyone involved. But the formation of clinical trials, as we know, was crystallizing. And every day it changed, and it was exciting and fun. Now we've kind of hit a saturation point. You see that PPD was purchased for billions of dollars. You know, you look at all of this mergers and going through, you see Syneos for sale. And at the time, I don't think any of us could ever believe that a site would be worth $5, $10, $15, $20 million. It's something that I'm very happy for my friends that have been able to sell. I don't think any of us ever thought it would be that amount of money. And there is no shortage of trials. There may be a shortage of contacts to get that placement going on there, but it will continue with or without me. The industry will continue. And I watch for changes all the time, but mostly what I could say right now I am seeing is a couple of things. The changing of the staff and the lack of multiple protocols from a pharma company. Back in the old days, you had AstraZeneca putting out 80 a year. Merck, Pfizer, Glaxo when they were in CNS. And you could really plan your income at a site level from that strategy. Now, there's a lot of one-offs and, you know, basically biotechs, and we're all hoping the best for that compound to continue for work. But a lot of times it doesn't work out. And so you don't have the vast amount of diversity in clinical trials that you had, you know, and including ones, if I dare say, that actually produce income. The protocols have never been as hard as they are now. They're no easier to fill than they were yesterday. I don't see a plan of action in the future of how they're going to change. In my opinion, and it is my opinion, the protocols are usually written by a clinician that has never owned a site or recruited a patient. That proposes the obvious. How would you recruit it? You probably don't know the nuances. And that is where we're sitting right now. So a site being profitable probably isn't as predictable as it was before. You know, our goal at usually the sites I work with is we take some of the very complex trials, hoping to really do that part for science, but we need some type of standard trial to recruit, to pay the light bills, to pay the staff. And nothing fills up very quickly. You know, I think the trials that usually fill up without a lot of advertising and so forth is smoking, something, you know, to stop smoking. That's when that's out there. Some pain trials. After that, it falls off the cliff. You know, you're screening many more patients than you used to get in trials.
Why do you think, you know, a couple questions here. You bring up so many great points. And again, is when you talk about these companies that have just morphed into huge companies, I think back to, I started at Quintiles before it was Quintiles in San Diego, was this little, probably 40, 50 person CRO that got bought by Quintiles. And at that point we were like 50 people. And then we got an office and we were a couple hundred people. And now I don't even know, you know, what IQVIA is. As CROs have gotten so big, pharma companies have kind of shrunk down. You know, they've stripped off a lot of things and outsourced to vendors. And then we've got biotech. So the distribution of size of companies that are the players in the field have shifted. You know, we hear a lot about sites having a tough time trying to pay for things. And, you know, maybe it's that they haven't negotiated budgets. You've got professional negotiators on the CROs, and you've got somebody who just wants to serve patients at the site. And sometimes that can end up with a little bit of a disparity between those two poles. How do we reconcile that?
Well, I think being honest about that, you know, the sites, I can tell you, have more power than they have in years. They have a right of refusal now. And I do see a dynamic shift, if not a little bit of panic, at CROs for the model that they created. I've always thought the work was undervalued. I think there's so many hidden costs in a clinical trial that if you don't have the experience to negotiate it, you're going to miss it. Sure. And, you know, getting fair market value is an opinion, you know, between the companies, what they think fair market value. I'm experiencing that right now in Mexico. They said it's going to be cheaper. So they sent a budget with $7 procedures. And I'm like, and, you know, and I laugh because, you know, one of the sponsors was on the call that we did yesterday. And I am being very truthful about it. I go, well, where do I start with that? Right. You know, everything is going to get really changed dramatically here. And what's going to slow it down is the contract negotiation. I'm taking my sweet time to get this back. I don't want anything missed. I think there are some good people that you can work with to do your contract negotiation if you don't have the experience out there. Dr. Daniel Fox, I'll give a shout out right there. He's does a remarkable job and has actually helped me as well with my clinical trials. And so what we're looking at is, again, you know, when you sell a site, they go through everything you can think of to provide that documentation and what it costs, so forth and so on. But again, it goes back to the power of the negotiator. If you can get the money that it costs to do it. And sometimes you don't know how much it's going to cost till you start the process. You know, you're like, well, I thought I projected this amount of patient screening to get to X amount, but it took twice as many. It turned out it wasn't a 40% screen failure rate. It was 75. And then you have to go back and do the modifications and, you know, try to get paid for your screen fails. And they try to cap it. And I'm like, well, we base screen fails off of what we thought was going to happen. But clearly we all see the trial is not filling. And we need to go back for that. And, you know, you get pushback. But in particular, the screen fails are probably one of the sticking points.
And why do you think, that we're seeing more screen fails than we used to?
Possibly. Some of the reasons for that could be, you know, the more complex protocols. Mm-hmm. They're not so straightforward. As we've gotten more sophisticated, so have they. What has changed the landscape is how many vendors are part of the contract. Mm-hmm. You know, even CROs have their amount of vendors. I think on one of the trials we looked, we had 22 different vendors on a trial. And if we think they're all, if we think they're all talking, well, I've got some cotton candy fields for sale for you. You know, it's just not happening. Best case scenario, we hope to bridge that gap, but it's hard to determine how that's going to happen.
You know, I think I often say that the people in clinical research are some of the hardest working, most good-natured people out there that truly care about people and want people to have outstanding health. You know, I would guess that those 22 vendors all really want to do a good job. But how do we get the community? It comes down to communication. Like, it sounds so basic and elementary, but if the people aren't talking, what happens?
Not a lot. Well, that's an issue. You know, it really can stop that when you're trying to find out what, you know, who's communicating from a central lab, who's doing advertising, who is doing regulatory, who is, you know, having investigator meeting refreshers, who is involved in this chain of command. And I don't see it as one particular person's fault. You know, you can't really lay it out that way. Again, it goes back to what's efficient and what's not efficient. And that is an opinion. Is your ultimate goal the number of patients you recruited to meet your investor's goal? You know, if you don't have money, is it because you know this is the best drug for your patient that you've ever seen? There's a lot of variables that go in this. But if I think everybody is communicating all at one time, I think that would be great. Even with our own groups within the hospital, our site, we have communications. You add a secondary location for that where everything is supposed to be exactly the same. You prepare the hamburger the same, but it's slightly different. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have an answer for that yet. I wish I did. Some of the things I think are cost savers right off the bat would be once a year rater certification. We're having to do that for each and every CNS trial. It's basically the same thing over and over and over. Your time really boils down to getting the trial start to two issues in CNS, rater certification and budget negotiation. Those two things stop the whole process. You can't get drug unless you finalize your contract, and you can't start the trial unless they've been certified as a rater. A lot of that means chasing that PI who is already so business and going on and saying, you know, I'm trying to get to this. I'll try to do it tonight. And then you start having numerous phone calls, numerous emails from everyone involved, escalates up to the project manager, creates quite a mess. And generally, I think that alone could dramatically save money and speed up the process. Now, there's vendors out there that don't want that to happen. You know, it's their business. They like the certification and what you bring to their company with revenue. I think everybody I talk to would like to try it once a year. But it hasn't been pushed enough yet, or at least not to the right audience. I'm not sure who ultimately is responsible for making that decision. Maybe one pharma company will step up and go, wow, we saved 50% of our time and money by putting this one thing in place. I'd like to see that personally happen. I'm not seeing much of a push internally. It's discussed, but there's no action.
And it seems like, you know, again, as I can look back to things that have been discussed over the last 25 years, and some of the things that we were discussing in 1995 are things that are still being discussed 28 years later today.
That's right.
you could almost take like an agenda from a meeting back then and change a few things. You'd have to put it at a cheaper hotel since you can't go anywhere nice anymore. And, no, and it would look very similar. So, you know, we've got some of these things, what you're talking about is annual rate or certification, budget negotiations, the complexity of protocols causing increased in the number of patients that need to be screened. Let's talk about patients for a minute here.
Yeah.
And we have this big push for patient centricity, although patients hate that term because it implies almost like that they're a specimen on a table and everyone's poking at them standing around. So it's really more patients around the table. I don't know what the right term is, but how do we get patients involved into this clinical trial process? And what's the payoff? And what are some of the downsides of having patients more involved?
Very good points. I can speak for recent activity. Let's look at COVID. Mm-hmm. I would say initially through the drama, the pandemic and everything that we could see, I think that people finally understood what the term clinical trial was. You know, they're like, oh, wow, that's what it means. And this is what it takes to get a drug approved. And so there was a good mentality. Let's roll up our sleeves and get this done. We're all good together. Let's get these vaccines. Let's protect the population. Let's educate people, so forth and so on. So for a moment, I saw a silver lining. I said, finally, they're going to understand what I've been doing for 30 years. And, you know, which was try to get exceptional medications through approval process out on the market. And so I did find that to be happening and that patients seemed to want to be involved and knew they were participating to help the greater of mankind, which overall in clinical trials is what we are trying to do. It is a business, but at a research level, and you know this, we're not trying to force an outcome. We collect the data the way that it's been designed to do, and we turn it back into the pharma CRO, and we wait to hear the results. Unfortunately, post-pandemic, the vaccines were politicized to the point where you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And suddenly, they didn't like you if you weren't vaccinated. They didn't like you if you were vaccinated. You know, you really couldn't navigate that. And particularly in our field, it was very revealing. You know, people that you worked with that understood the clinical trial process are like, I'm not doing it. And I'm like, that's interesting. I was sure that we'd have about a 99% compliance with that one thing. Afterwards, by the boosters, we started losing interest. And so in one way, it actually backfired. And that is something that I wasn't prepared to see. But I do think that some people actually were turned off by it and didn't understand their contribution. And so at this point, moving forward, I feel like we've got to start again in some aspect of getting the patient involved and what they're actually doing. Maybe that's at the site level, that when they come in, you're really more detailed about what the drug might be able to do and what it might be able to do in the market and the history going forward with individuals.
I love that, that piece about what the drug might be able to do for you and what the drug might be able to do if it's approved and, you know, ultimately who you may be able to benefit and impact. You know, a friend of mine just recently was screened for an Alzheimer's study and it was a genetic study. And if he had a certain gene, it increased the likelihood that he would get Alzheimer's. He received a 25-page informed consent, solid text, and was then quizzed on it for 2 hours at the site to see if he had actually read it. The process was less than desirable in his opinion. And then he found out he did not have the gene, which was good news because then his chance of Alzheimer's was reduced. However, the way that he worded it to me, he said he was rejected for the trial. And it's a sense of, he wasn't given the information in a way that supported him as an individual, in a way that honored him, in a way that informed. And I think that there's been a big miss with that. If someone's screened for a trial, I hear this a lot. People are screened for a trial. They don't qualify. They don't know why, or else they're on the trial. They never hear if the drug's approved. They never hear which arm of the trial they were in. And there's this like kind of uneasiness incompleteness is maybe a better word, with the sense of participation. And I'm just curious if that's contributing to people not really wanting to be as involved as we might hope.
I think it's an excellent point. And I can remember when consent forms were about 8 pages. And even at that point, I had trouble figuring out if they had read it. Personally, myself, if I was going there and saw 40 pages, I'd probably be skimming through it pretty quickly. I think that you have a tendency to sign your name on the back and print your name and put the date, assuming that everything has been explained to you already. Now, right. For your friend that went out there, the good news was they did not have the gene. Was there an education about the benefits of that? Maybe not. Obviously, it was probably a relief. But where you lose it is your ability to make a recommendation referral for someone else you may know. You know, maybe they need to get in, and you could say, this is how I was treated, which hopefully would be a good situation here. I went in there. They were very thorough, explained the purpose of the trial, what the drug may do. And we're all, as we age, obviously hoping for good news with Alzheimer's in particular. You know, we're all knocking on the door of that right now. But I think that when people are lost to follow up there, I don't like to lose touch with that patient. They may qualify for something else. Maybe that wasn't the right match for them. And we really have to determine at a site level who is actually qualified. But your point is well taken about getting that data. I don't see a plan of action on how to release that information to the patient. I don't know if they feel that's a conflict of interest when they're doing it. Maybe they don't need to know, or who had the drug that made it work. They're not wanting to break that blind. Were you on a placebo or not? I'm not sure. But that is an initial thought I have. That may be one of the things. But I think we're missing out on having someone tell our story for us when they leave. You know, I participated in a, you know, 3-month study. I love the staff. The staff was informative, made me feel validated as a human being. I did not feel like a guinea pig, which guinea pig is the terminology that they use for all clinical trials, isn't it? You know, that is the basic understanding, is that you are a guinea pig.
Do you remember there's that Time magazine article from about 20 years ago with the human sitting inside a cage, and it says, it talks about human guinea pigs in clinical trials?
I don't, but I want to research and look at that.
Oh yeah. I'll send you a picture of it.
Yeah, do that. I think it's always been that case, and particularly for phase one trials. And I spent a lot of time in phase one. I was actually the gatekeeper. I was the individual that would explain to you why you were taking a drug for the first time and what could or could not happen. Oddly, they only made you list 3 side effects in the consent form. And oh, what did we put? Nausea, migraine, stomach upset, diarrhea, almost always. You never went down the fine print at the bottom, like the commercials that go so fast. You may have da-da-da. You know, it doesn't seem like those commercials could be real. Mm-hmm. All that information is in the consent form that you have. But back in the day, the regulatory arm of it only required you to list 3 things that might happen to you.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I put in 3,000 subjects for phase one trials. And so I'm pretty good at knowing that information.
So let's talk about, you know, speaking of phase one and speaking of some of the newer things out on the market, let's talk about psychedelics.
We love psychedelics.
And such an interesting turn into the industry. How do you think psychedelics are going to impact the industry?
I think, again, I'm going to go forward. There was a shift, generational shift post-pandemic. When everybody was at home, I think people had a chance to really review their lives and find out what was working and not. I think a generation that's beneath us or two has seen marginal mixed results with SSRIs for depression. Mm-hmm. Other things that they've been looking at, they're like, well, I've known somebody on antidepressants for 20 years and they never reached a point where they felt like they were okay or their life improved dramatically. So I think I'm going to say it's an age difference for me that people were looking at it. I started getting calls from people that I knew that said, hey, I'm trying this microdosing. And I was really thought that was so interesting. I go, well, how's that working for you? You know, how was that on your Zoom call? Are you to the point where your employer could say that you can't do your job, you know, for this reason? You know, you may have someone terribly conservative that cannot believe what you've said, you know, because of course we know it is still illegal in most locations, you know, that you're having with regard to research. It's state by state that you can do this. But I started hearing this dialogue from people, and I was very interested in it. And I said, I have had loose association, now more association with psychedelics in trials. And in the last 2 years, I've been involved with basically most that are running. I have a site or two that are on the big ones like MindMed, Compass Pathway, Cybin, Trip. These are all companies that are going to continue to move forward. Most of it is psilocybin, but we do have LSD for one. Mm-hmm. And of course, just talking about it, it's fascinating. You're like, wow, how's that going to work? And what's your endpoint? And how do you do it? Well, what they're doing, and I found out, is a lot of these companies are underfunded. They have a compassion for wanting new research, which is the exciting part. A lot of the founders have a personal tie-in for psychedelics, why they want it to work. Maybe it's impacted their family or saw something, maybe themselves personally. And so it's coming out of the shadows where people are actually saying, I tried it, you know, and that's the biggest change, I think, was people actually acknowledging, well, yeah, I think I will try that, or I know someone that tried that and it really worked. We're starting to see it move out of the known indications, and I'll speak to that. You know, we've known for a while that people were using this for depression, PTSD, but the exciting part we're seeing now is they're moving into addiction. Yep. They're doing addiction right now. They don't feel you get addicted to psychedelics, but you do opiates and you do alcohol, and they're moving that direction. It's moving into oncology. It's your quality of life and end of life that they're doing. And I think that's fascinating. And most of us have probably been affected with somebody with cancer by now in their lives. And I've seen how brutal that is for everyone involved, the family, the patient, the individual. And so I really like seeing us going out in this new direction. And I think it's worthwhile. I do. We're getting the enrollment halfway underway for most of these companies. I did see a cooling off at the beginning of the year. I think the investors said, well, I'm uncertain of our general economy out in the United States in particular right now. And so let's wait till they get their data. Let's wait a year and see what Cybin said, what MindMed said. And of course, we're all hoping for the best. You know, no one is trying to force the outcome, but I think you will get more major pharma getting in other than biotech, if you will, if they see some results that are profitable. Let's face it. Most of the major pharma will not take a compound out that doesn't have a $1 billion revenue. That was a Pfizer thing. And when I first heard it, I gasped. You know, I thought, well, that's amazing. And, you know, the largest clinical trials are thousands and thousands of individuals. But the day that you write the script for the first time, it goes into millions. And sometimes that's why you see the side effects later that we did not anticipate. It's a larger sample size. And so what I'm seeing on the psychedelic level is one, the tremendous interest. You know, it's really great to be on the phone with people that are talking about it, that have a story to tell, that actually have their sites up and running. From a site level, I can tell you that it's been more expensive than anticipated. Mm. You have to set up a dosing room. Generally, they want those to have a bathroom inside the dosing room. And if you're at the site level and familiar with it, you know, usually that's not the setup. It's in the hall. You know, you might have your phlebotomy there and you might have go in and give your urine sample, but they don't want you, quote unquote, tripping, you know, right, literally at going across the hall on your psychedelic. And some companies have been a little bit more lenient with that. Some have not. And so for sites that are existing, primarily if they had a phase one unit or they had an inpatient unit, they might have that set up. Otherwise, they've had to convert. And the way the sponsor wants it, and for those who have never had exposure to this, they don't want you to look clinical in these studies. They're going to have the dosing room, which looks like a spa. You know, there's always a water feature, right? You know, and
almost a fun. Dim lighting, nice music. Dim lighting,
almost what you think would be in a dosing room. Mm-hmm. But as a clinician, you're not allowed to wear a lab coat, mm-hmm, anything like that. Anything that looks clinical at all. They want to look like I came over to your house and we did the drug. And, you know, and because most of the time you're in there for at least 10 hours.
Yeah.
And you think about it, to me, when I first saw that, I go, wow, that's going to be like being in The Shining. I could never be in a room for 10 hours on a hallucinogen. But that is the rules. And some are even more complex where you have to be blindfolded during the trial. That to me is a little frightening. you know, to think, at least I would know if you were standing next to me, you were in the room, but they're trying to take out anything that could interrupt evaluating that data. And I do get it. So they're not for everybody. They're not. I can say the screen fail rate has been very high. You know, we're looking at up to 75% screen fail rate.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, the ones that we've been seeing is not everybody's been honest about their psychedelic use. Mm. And I think that's very interesting because I think probably if you're out in the world in the United States obtaining mushrooms, is it going to be that hard? You know, they're out there floating as a social drug and, you know, going out there. I don't think it would be that difficult. So I do find it interesting that someone would respond to the ad, if you will, to come in and forget to say, oh, I've done it before. Sometimes a criteria doesn't exclude you for that. You know, they want you really washed out of your antidepressants, so forth and so on. But by doing that, you also create a history that maybe people won't qualify to get in the trial. Either they're not washed out, or they've taken too many, or they can't have a history of antidepressants at all. And if you're looking at doing depression, you're going to eliminate the bulk of those people that might try this treatment.
Right. You know, so if you're looking at, if you're wanting to have a psychedelic naive patient, what are you going to do? Go down to the elementary school and recruit moms and be like, hey, yeah, while your kid's at school, you can come to the clinic for 10 hours.
Yeah. You know, because no one has the metrics and data on that. It's evolving. Mm-hmm. And with anything that's evolving, there's opportunity. And I think something that the sites will probably do is learn from previous mistakes of something they did. The site level, they're very excited to work on this because it is different. It's not the same thing we've been doing in my case, 33 years. It's interesting to see what data they're collecting, what the interaction is with the patient. And of course, stepping out of that circle and looking at the patient, yeah, it's interesting. You pretty much know who's on placebo, who's not for these drugs. And obviously, if you're sitting in there, it's very interesting to lend an ear and hear what they have to say. Hmm.
So let's go back for a minute here. You know, there was, you probably heard about Roland Griffiths at Johns Hopkins, one of the big psychedelic researchers, yes, diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and talking about how he hadn't done a whole lot of psychedelics and then did some, and how that had really helped him with his end of life journey. There's so many different indications that they're looking at psychedelics for. Where do you think is going to be the biggest impact?
Well, I could speak with what I think will be approved first. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there's a general feeling that the first thing that'll be approved will be for depression.
Yep.
I think depression is going to be out there. And I think PTSD are the two that we've been comfortable with this treatment. I think when we're discussing things like cancer and end of life treatment, that it's not something that people have really given thought to, but then they pause and they go, oh yeah, I could see how that would benefit. And we would like to do anything we could to make that compassionate care happen. And you're right. I think there is so many indications of, you know, there's postpartum depression that's out there right now. And that's very interesting, you know, for that patient population. Will women want to stop breastfeeding? Will women be open to an investigational compound when they're in such dire need of treatment? Mm-hmm. I'm just going to tell. This is all happening now. And so, you know, ask me a year from now what happened will be probably a different answer than what I think is going to happen. I thought we'd be a little bit further ahead this year. I did. I thought we'd have a few more companies that I'm working with. One is for stroke recovery using psilocybin, which is very interesting. Things that you wouldn't think of that may be utilized. They're still in the wings, but they're not quite there yet. And a lot of it has to do, again, with there's no data to base it up for your investor, how many patients it took to get in, what it really cost, what you could have done differently. It's all being formatted literally right now.
You talked a bit, Zane, about the psychedelic companies being underfunded. What's it going to take, do you think, for them to either be able to get more funding or sold, acquired to a pharma company? What's it going to take? Because you and I both know research is expensive.
It's and, very expensive.
You know, there's a lot of great, very altruistic thoughts about making all of this free and cheap, but it's expensive. The bottom line, sites have to be paid. Patients have to be accommodated for their time. buildings have to be paid for.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. And I think what the determining factor, in my opinion, and all of this is my opinion, of course, today, is it's costing so much money up front for the site that is not able to be something that can retrieve. Mm-hmm. You know, some, not all the companies, but some of the companies come and go, well, you should have that because if you're going to do our trial, that's just the qualifications you need. You need a room with a bathroom. You need the guide, if you will, that they have there that's going to do that. And that's a very interesting category as well that mm-hmm. you have. And so there are expenses that are normally part of what we think of when we're doing a trial. And again, it goes back to some of the sponsors will say, well, there is no recruitment budget, but we want you to look internally at your database who may qualify. And again, how do you know? How do you know? There is are individuals that have never heard of the treatments like this, or may be scared, or maybe you get a patient population that did psychedelics in the glory days, the 60s and the 70s, that said, oh, wow, I did it back then. You mean I can use it for this part of my life? And I've actually had several people that have told me that. They said, I felt comfortable with it, but it's been since 69. And I said, yeah, you know, last time you were at Woodstock, you know, that you did this, but there is a population that feels comfortable with it due to age. And then I would say the middle ground, people are unsure, but you go younger and they're willing as well. So you have this middle ground of people that are kind of on the fence. Should I try it? Or maybe I have nothing to lose, which again goes back to some of the other indications that are terminal. You know, I could see why maybe at this point, if you're in horrific pain or if you have cancer or if you have a variety of other things that affect us as a human population, a human being, that you'd be more willing. And so my education that I'm taking back to the sponsors is what we have internally. Well, we've done 33 depression trials. You know, out of those, 25 got marketed. You know, we thought our patients did well with that, or we thought our patients did good on a drug that you discontinued. And, you know, there's that too. You know, at the time we're running it, it looked great. Looked like mm-hmm. patients were responding, and then they tell you they put it on hold, it goes, and you're like, wow, I didn't see that coming. Well, welcome to research. That is why we do research. We're not running it until somebody dies. You know, if that unfortunately happens in a trial, and it does happen. You know, we try to figure out what that serious adverse was and make adjustments if possible. And so there's a learning curve with psychedelics in the entire industry. You have really good people that have been speaking a long time out there. And I would say Angela Hartgrove, who will probably listen to this, is the person that you should really go to for more psychedelics.
Yeah.
You've got quite an interesting story there. I'm looking at it from a slightly different business model. The companies that I work with that are running initial psychedelics are really located overseas. You know, we have First in Man studies running in Australia, where the regulations are going, and they actually will pay you back a percentage on the dollar. I'm probably misquoting. It's about 41 cents back on a dollar that you get up front. Well, if you're a company trying to run your trial, you're probably going to look at that and go, wow, you mean they're going to pay for 40, 50% of my trial and we can start it in there? And ideally, if it works, you bring it back to the States, because that's where the credibility comes from, is if you go into the States. Well, if we're running it here, it gets approved. That's how they see it. You know, there's groups that I work with in London, Clerkenwell Health. They're doing a lot of phase one trials, First in Man, and they're doing that successfully. And so all eyes are on those companies. And I do work with those companies, and we have meetings, and we're going, well, how's it looking? They have the same issues we have. In the States, you have to get a Schedule I license, and that can take 3 or 4 months. Well, it's under the doctor's name. So if that doctor is no longer your doctor, you have to start all over. How does this impact your you know, timelines? A great deal.
For sure.
It does. You know, and so far, most psychedelic studies I have had somewhat of a delay. Most has been out of their control. It's nothing they have done to not be qualified. It could be a staffing issue. You know, it could be the facility. And again, getting that certification are critical to these type of trials.
So as we consider, you know, psychedelics, some of the treatment protocols require 2 guides or therapists in the room, one of each gender, with a patient for 8, 10 hours.
Yeah.
how is this treatment going to be affordable if someone's doing multiple doses over a period of time plus follow-up appointments in between?
Well, I think that the first thing I would say is they're hoping to decrease the amount of drug you take in the time versus taking an antidepressant every day for 30 days. Maybe you're going to take this treatment twice a month. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the cost savings would be, I think, from that, just that you won't have to take a drug as much. What's the drug going to cost, though? I don't know. Yeah. And nobody knows yet. I think everybody has very good intentions. They, especially in the psychedelic field, they really do want to help people. They really do. But having said that, we know being in this industry, it's a business that costs a lot to run it. You know, when people are like, I can't believe what that drug costs, I'm not really shocked. I don't have the answer how to decrease that. But when I see it come out, I'm like, well, I know how many hands are in this process. There are roles that no one would ever think. I mean, I have a job securing clinical trials for my research sites. That's nothing anybody would ever think would be something that you compensate for, you know, or maybe like yourself, you're recruiting patients through an agency and doing it. Oh, I didn't know that existed. So there's a lot of gray area of roles that aren't even well known within the industry sometimes even. I don't think people necessarily know what I do. They might know me, but they're like, what does he do? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's true. I'm a spokesperson and advocate for the field in particular in the CNS area. But I think there's hidden costs everywhere along the line. And I think that will be determined after we've had a few trials. I think at this point, nobody knows. They may say they do, but I don't know how you would.
When you're looking at these trials, specifically for psychedelics, are there certain classes of people or certain groups of people more likely? You know, we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. How likely are more diverse groups to want to participate?
I think that's a very good question. I've been looking for that right now. I can say that primarily the patients that I've seen the most have been Caucasian at this point. So are we reaching a diverse audience? Doesn't look like it so far, you know, but I think there are some groups that are doing heavy recruitment for psychedelic trials. And I think they're really looking at that. And, you know, there's an amazing group in Atlanta that's enrolling more diverse patients. But I think overall, most of those calls coming through have not been. And it would be the same thing that I would ask, why? Why is it like that for the trials we're running? Is it not reaching the socioeconomic group of people that might not have money for a treatment? Or is it that people do have money and they're interested in something that is exotic and something to try?
Right. Or the people that maybe don't have the money, there might not be the trust and the lack of control. Yeah. You know, you think about the classic psychedelic trip, and if someone's not terribly trusting of the medical establishment, are they then going to trust them to take them on this kind of vulnerable experience?
Right. Yeah. You're going to definitely feel like a fish out of water. There's no way around it, you know, and I look at the criteria, some of this too, and I'm like, well, these patients are definitely going to feel it. You know, these are not, ideally, I think we want to go with the lowest dose they can ever find. But, you know, in the process of determining that, there's all kinds of doses. And so I'm seeing that too, right now, that people will be there 10, even 12 hours. And at that point, can you drive? Should you drive? Or, you know, so some of the sites that we're working with, they provide the transportation to and from, which I'm really more comfortable with for the patient. Whether it's a criteria or not, I just so personally feel comfortable saying, here's your car keys, you know, not for me, but I don't make the rules, you know, and I always make the joke, give me a hammer, I'll fix it all. My personal opinion sometimes has nothing to do with what we have to do. And I would say that's the same basis for people in research. You know, we've always had to separate that, you know, from a physician standpoint, when you're trained, it's to get an outcome and making a patient better. You know, I think that's instilled on you. But when you're working in research, that's not the end point. That's the hope that you're going to make a patient better. But as you're going through the process, you are trying to be not liberal, not conservative, in the middle. You know, whether your personal preference is either or, when it comes to research, we are going to err to the more conservative side. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. You know, I know when to flip on the other hat, but I think right now we do need to be conservative with this and make sure that we're meeting all the criteria that is put out in the drug protocol.
Yeah. Right. And it's, you know, I think it's even having patients involved in those protocols to give us a realistic idea, is this feasible or not? Because they would probably look at something like a psychedelic protocol that says that they should drive a, you know, a period of time later and be like, wait a minute, I'm not comfortable with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're going to collect a lot of that data at this first round. And I think these companies, and I applaud them for being pioneering in this, mm-hmm. you know, they knew this already. A lot of them, how difficult this would be. And so I really do appreciate people like, you know, in particular, Cybin, really trying to be out there and run this and raise awareness. And they do a really good job with that. They're very active on LinkedIn in the community and advertising and advocacy. And I think they're doing everything they think is the right thing to do. And I'm very supportive of that. It costs a lot of money to do those things before you've made money. Mm-hmm. And at this point, none of these drugs are approved. So everyone's always in the process of raising money, venture capital, private equity. And I've done it, and it's hard. It's so hard to do it. You're told no so often that you become a little bit Teflon and bulletproof and go, I'm expecting that. Or you get a soft yes, but we'll get you the second round.
Right.
Get through your initial. And I'm like, well, I need the upfront money. I've got a lot of people that want to go in the second round. But that's really the way it is right now. And so you have to have tough skin. You have to have really qualified individuals telling the story out there. Because again, a lot of people are interested, and it doesn't mean they're interested and they want to take the drug, but they see the benefit.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I've heard of many people. There's a woman here locally who even just started ketamine this week. And she was talking about how she felt like she got years of therapy in one session.
Yeah. Absolutely. And down in the area I'm at, and your parents, Rosarito Beach has been known for a couple of decades for doing off-label treatments such as ketamine. Mm-hmm. You know, ketamine wasn't covered by insurance for the vets. And this is something that was really startling to me. And I learned a lot more about advocacy groups from that. So those veterans, in particular from San Diego, have been journeying over here, over the border, to do this treatment. And they're doing it with all psychedelics here. And somehow they're getting through that. But I'm hearing the same thing. This has been remarkable. I haven't had any change for 20 years. And I feel change from this process after the first, second time. And that's exciting. Mm-hmm. I've had friends have the treatment that have suffered with depression in particular for decades. And they feel like it's a value and it's worthwhile. And for people out there that don't know ketamine in particular, you know, it is an animal tranquilizer at its root when it started. Then it became a recreational party drug for a time period too, which was always very interesting because I thought, well, you're going to pass out. How fun could that be if you're at a dance club and you fall to the floor? And I saw it happen. I actually saw that happen. And so now I think we're retooling that again to go, okay, we see practical applications. But it's interesting how some drugs can actually have an origin that you wouldn't expect. An animal tranquilizer. You know, and then of course they spun it and changed it and did a few other things, but that's kind of how that started.
There, Andrew Huberman of the Huberman podcast just did a great podcast on ketamine. Real interesting, and you know, the different pathways and the different thoughts behind it and different modes of administration. And he was talking about, he was looking at one paper that said this way was the way that was most effective, and another paper that said exactly the opposite thing.
Yeah.
And he was calling his friends at Stanford saying, how do I make sense of this? And I think there are still so many things that are unknown. And as we're in this kind of new frontier of treatments for the CNS indications, that is exciting, you know, and I think too, it's exciting what you're doing down in Baja, because you really are ushering in a new frontier, a new option for folks that maybe wouldn't have had access to clinical trials, and you know, opening up that door to thousands of patients,
potentially millions.
Right.
You know, there really hasn't been any focus on clinical trials in this area of Baja. you know, and again, I'm speaking for a geographic area that, you know, runs down this little peninsula, but mostly the border. You know, San Diego is very populated with professional research sites. There's an ad every 5 minutes. We know that, you know, constantly. Mm-hmm. You see it on the TV, you see it on the paper, you hear it on the radio, and call this number if you have XYZ at Central Campaigns. I don't have any history of that down here yet. The trials that I have selected, we can recruit internally, but I will be looking at that next year, branching it out further as we take other types of trials. And, you know, right now, again, it's strictly based on what I'm seeing internally at the hospital, but I have big plans. I have big plans to bring this option for patient treatment to Tijuana in particular. And Tijuana has a burgeoning medical tourism industry, and we should probably touch on that. In the last 5 years in particular, it's relatively shocking if you come over the border. You know, you went through this horrible period down here of the narco wars, which was really true. Got glamorized on television, so forth and so on. But you're familiar with this area, pretty much decimated. Tourist yep. towns like Rosarito Beach, they were empty. People vacated their homes. And so what's so exciting now is they pretty much have a grip on that. And knock on wood, this changes daily, as you know. But I feel like that I'm in a safe environment. I feel like if you're going to Tijuana, you're safe. You can find trouble anywhere you look. But I think what we're seeing on the television and the yelling and screaming, I don't find to be the case here. I don't. I walk freely up in the city. Maybe I'm not going to go down in the back roads at night. I wouldn't do that in the States.
Right.
But I really wouldn't. But I really had to fight a perception of what this border is like. And again, perception, reality, the perception and reality were the same at one point here. It was true. You wouldn't just come over here. And because I keep going back to, you're familiar with the area. When I first started coming out to Baja in the 90s, it was American. You know, people lined up to go to Puerto Nuevo, the lobster village with their family. You pretty much saw some underage drinking, you know, the military coming down here, and just a great time everyone had. And it really did cater to Americans. Mm-hmm. It really did. Well, you know, flash forward, cartels and, you know, everything that happened, that spirit is probably lost forever. You know, a lot of these houses were actually squatters. They took the Americans' houses and they left them, and that's the way it is now. But what I see is city blocks being torn down for medical tourism. So that's where they found their new niche. It's not the tequila and Revolution Avenue that, you know, people came down for. It's, oh, I can get state-of-the-art treatment for a rare disease, a terminal disease, or I can go the other way and have my cosmetic procedures done. And there is a lot of that here. Now, that's where you see the advertising. Get the perfect lips, the Brazilian yep, butt yep. lift,
right?
You know, your liposuction, your tummy tuck. And I've actually had friends that have had them done and stay at my house. You know, they're like, I'm going to get this done. And I'm like, okay, we'll come recover at Casa Rio here. And that's where the money is coming from in this town, is that. And literally, there's skyscrapers going up everywhere, dedicated solely for medical tourism. Will that elevate the term clinical trial? You better believe it. I'm counting on it. I hope to work and partner with some of these companies and go out and say, perhaps this is an option for the patient you're seeing as a clinical trial. They come to you for a certain treatment or an evaluation. Maybe there's something you can't offer them, but maybe I can. So I'm going to do a lot of branding and a lot of hands-on going out in the next year, you know, advocacy groups and just outreach, you know, like we do in the States for groups. I think we're going to do a lot of that. My Spanish better increase dramatically for this, you know, by, you know, check back with me, people, later on this to see. But I think that's where the revenue is coming now. And, you know, people come over from San Diego very easily for it. It used to be your orthodontics. Mm-hmm. Everyone says, I'll go to the dentist in Tijuana. It's so much cheaper and they're good. And we're not talking back alley treatment. You know, people have a perception, you know, that you've been here. You know, but people are like, well, I don't know if I trust the doctor. I'm like, well, come into Angels Hospital where I am, where you could eat off the floor. You know,
that's my mom. As I've told you, my mom has a house not far from you over there. And she's had a lot of things done down in Mexico. And her dentist went to Loma Linda in California. Yeah. Like, so he's from Loma Linda, but he just practices in Mexico. And I've told you there's a functional medicine hospital I used to take people on to retreats in Rosarito called Santa Vive. And it is a state-of-the-art cancer hospital with all kinds of alternative treatments that people couldn't get access to here in the US. Yeah. So if you were to describe for those folks that, you know, have only heard about the narco wars and what they see on TV of Tijuana, I think of the sweet little artisan bakery that I walk to from my mom and stepdad's place, or the, you know, the lobster burritos and whatnot. How would you describe the facilities in Mexico for someone who's never been there?
It's going to be a welcome surprise. I think when you're deciding you're going to come over here, you should look at a couple of things for an extended stay. What you're not expecting is if you go 45 minutes to an hour down from the border, that you're in a glorious wine country that is building and exploding with boutique hotels, eco-friendly hotels, little igloos, if you will. My other half's family actually opened one in the wine valley. That's the money. So what they're trying to do is say, come get your treatment here, recover in the valley. Come down here, enjoy our coastline, come to Rosarito Beach. But know that our facilities are state of the art. You know, it's competitive, even internally in the area, and that does foster opportunity and growth of a better facility. So I think that, you know, what you've heard before, you know, there was some truth to that. There was at one time. What you're seeing now, though, is a robust, flourishing Mexican economy with people shopping left and right, people getting procedures, people updating their appearance. We have a Mexican economy that is moving more to middle class than ever in the history of this country. I think that is, you know, a major difference driving factor. And also generationally, the younger individuals, they don't want some of the old stuff. You know, it's surprisingly liberal in Baja. Gay marriage is legal. Abortion's legal. These are non-issues and non-political issues for people that live here. Mm. And the dramatic change of the United States in that regard, how polarizing it is, whatever your personal belief is, and I respect that, that you have a right to choose on that, that's not an issue here. So when people come here, that's not how they're evaluating what the country's like. They're saying, is that a good doctor? Are they following up? Can I get a treatment that's less expensive than the United States? Alternative treatment to what's in the United States. And I think I would say that, you know, and again, I go back to anyone listening out there, you know, Leanne knows her parents live probably 2 miles from me down the road or so forth. So we get to enjoy the fun stuff, you know, that's here. I think it's a great alternative for you to research if you want to look at another medical treatment. I have people that are flying in from Canada and all around the world. So it's not coming just from the United States. I think a perception from Americans is that people only in San Diego might go over the border and get something done. Not the case whatsoever. Mm-hmm.
This has been fantastic, Zane, and I appreciate you so much and your perspectives. You know, your history in the industry is outstanding. Your ability to give perspective, your ability to kind of lay out what the course of the future of the industry may be is remarkable as well. Where can people get in touch with you?
I'm found on LinkedIn, you know, so you'll see Zane Corbay there. C-O-U-R-B-A-Y is on there. And if you Google Baja Clinical Trials, I should pop up towards the end of that. You'll see the glamour photo that they give you that you never authorized go on those websites, right? I'm like, I love that person. I wish I looked like that person in that photo. But, you know, I think those are the best ways to get me. And I welcome any question whatsoever or any feedback. I have always believed in this industry, and I kind of serve as an ambassador for that we're stronger together. And it's always been the way that I have felt in my personal and professional life. And I think I'll just close with saying that the people in research are undervalued, even in a perception. I think that everyone goes, oh, big pharma, the marketing, the commercial, the pill and the name. I don't like it. But yet they're missing out on the story of how the drug got there. Drugs don't get themselves approved. People get drugs approved. And I think that, you know, I would just ask people to do a little research into that. You can Google clinical trials in your area, you know, put Tampa, Florida, clinical trials, RA, you know, something like that. And I guarantee these places are going to pop up. It's worthwhile to look into alternatives for you. We're seeing tremendous changes in Alzheimer's right now. You know, we just had a drug come out that proved 35% slowdown of this disease. And there's never been anything like that. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in that, you should be looking in your area, Alzheimer's clinical trials. What can they offer me? And often too, just so people know out there, you are compensated for doing a drug trial. So, you know, you could have your transportation covered, medical records, you can get a lot of things. You can have an ear, listen to your problem. And I think that's where you're going to see a big difference from your normal place that you may go, doctor's office, that you're under tremendous pressure, people, number, going all this stuff there. Whereas with the clinical trial, you know, the goal would be that you would really have a chance to contribute to science and, you know, the betterment of, frankly, mankind. Maybe this treatment's not for you. Maybe it's for your friend's kid, you know, your partner's dad. It's all inclusive. And that's really what we want in this industry, is everybody to participate, everyone to recognize their value. And, you know, and I think that'll make a better industry for everybody.
Completely agree. And, you know, also anybody that you know that's ever taken any form of medication, that the only way that they're able to take that product is because someone did a clinical trial.
That's right. And someone did it before you. And so mm-hmm. before we politicize every clinical trial and see that used against you, I say do your own research. And really, when I say research, I don't mean sound bites, conspiracy websites that are all out there that giving misinformation. Look at the company website, you know, look at the drug company, look at the people in your area and see who's running it. You're going to find some good individuals out there.
Yeah. Yeah. So good. Thank you so much, Zane.
It's a pleasure.
We put the links so that people can get in touch with you on the show notes. And this has been fantastic.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to come on. I respect your ability to get in touch with so many people in the industry. And I'm pleased to be part of that. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Clinical Research Coach. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you'd subscribe and leave a rating and a review. I truly hope that you got something out of this episode that can help us all work towards our goal of making a meaningful difference in the lives of others.